You are listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of November 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 30 minutes, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan calls for the world to respect the country's parliamentary election result, which gave his AK party nearly half of the vote. Some fear that a return to single-party rule could have an impact on the country's democracy. My guests John Everard and Peter Fleming will discuss this and the other main stories of the day, including South Korean President Park Geun-hye and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe hold their first formal bilateral talks, pledging to resolve disputes over wartime history and to counter the nuclear threat from North Korea. In Australia, Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull says it's time to stop saying sir as he scraps knighthoods from the nation's honours system. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are John Everard, the UK's former ambassador to Uruguay, Belarus and North Korea, and Peter Fleming, Professor of Business and Society at Cass Business School. John and Peter, welcome to you both. We'll begin with the Turkish election results. The country's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has today called for the whole world to respect his country's parliamentary election result, which gave his AK party nearly 50% of the vote. The outcome of the vote came as a surprise to many, as opinion polls had predicted a replay of the June election, when the AKP lost its majority for the first time in 13 years. The pro-Kurdish HDP did win the 10% necessary to get seats in parliament, but saw its share of the vote fall since the last election just 5 months ago. John Everard, a slightly surprising election result, and one which perhaps suggests that fear and instability helped Erdogan and his party to reclaim power.
Yes, in both senses. Fear and instability, or fear of instability amongst the electorate, seems to have swung a lot of people to vote for the man they regard as the strong man of Turkey, the man who will keep the place together and prevent violence in the streets. The parallels with Putin are obvious and uncomfortable. Fear and instability also in the sense that it was clear that a lot of violence was used, especially in the southeast. I mean, Diyarbakir for a while was in a state of not quite civil war, but there was a great deal of unrest on the streets, and it looks as if there was a certain amount of, shall we say, intimidation of people who might have voted for Erdogan's various opponents. The OSCE report, the ODIHR report, also talks about massive manipulation of the media. This election was probably fair in the sense that nobody has challenged the actual electoral process, but the lead up to it and the way that campaigning by Erdogan's opponents was curtailed certainly are a huge blemish on Turkish democracy. And I suspect that a lot of his opponents will be very, very angry at what has happened.
Peter, picking up that issue on the media, I mean, when you look at the number of times that the AKP were talked about favourably on government-backed media compared to the other parties, it's astonishing. It's, you know, if you're a member of another party, you weren't getting any airtime at all. And you know, as John says, fine, that the vote may have been fair, but if the background to the vote is this unfair, then that surely calls into question the morality of this election result.
Yeah, sure. And I also think that, straight after the Ankara bombing, that was leveraged quite well by the ruling party to kind of create this atmosphere of fear. You know, opponents called it the victory of fear through this election, but there have been worse elections, you know, around the world. By and large, this was a relatively unproblematic election in a technical sense, but it's quite clear that opponents would be very, very unhappy, especially the Kurds, who've, been fighting a proxy civil war via Assad and Syria with the ruling party. The Western secularists also would be very unhappy about this result as well. I think probably the only the only groups that would be over the top, apart from the ruling party, would be, you know, those who are thinking about the problem in Syria and the migration problem, who want stability. They want a strong authoritarian government, and they've got one now.
And that's the interesting thing, isn't it, John? Because for all that the European Union may well be uncomfortable with the fact that that there's been this huge crackdown on media, that it hasn't been a fair election in the sense that parties haven't been able to have their say, that there is this insecurity and instability, there are also many within the European Union that will think, well, at least with Erdogan in charge, we know what we're dealing with here, and we've sort of struck a deal with him anyway on migration. This might help us in the long term.
No, I don't think that's right. I don't think that there will be any enthusiasm in European capitals for what has happened. Yes, Erdogan is strong, you can deal with him, and he can impose his will, sure. But I think that the arguments against that are much stronger, that Europeans in general would have preferred a much clearer representation of popular opinion across Turkey. I mean, it's clear that a lot of it has been suppressed, and they would have preferred an election not marred by this violence and by this media rigging, whatever the result.
When we look at the issues to come, sort of in the months and years to come, one of the big issues inside Turkey is going to be the Kurdish problem, the Kurdish issue. And we've seen essentially two different strategies from Erdogan in the past few years. There were the overtures towards the PKK, the suggestion there would be peace talks, the actual peace talks taking place. And now there's been a crackdown once again. What do you foresee happening in the coming months and years?
I think a lot of it depends upon what's happening in Syria as much as anything else, because the Kurds have been kind of caught in the middle, in the sense they're fighting Assad, but also they're fighting the ruling party in Turkey as well. So it all depends, but it does seem that they're curtailing violent, I think John's right, violent and kind of unacceptable curtailing of media freedoms in Turkey should really be worrying to observers. And let's just hope it's not a taste of things to come, but it does look like that under the cloak of the instability in the area more generally. So they've leveraged that very, very well to kind of bring in an authoritarian twist to the government strategy that they're using. And I think we've got to be very, very worried about that.
Yes. Can I just make a technical point here? European reaction, you mentioned the EU. It's actually going to be a much more condition, not by the EU, but by the OSCE, who are the European body responsible for monitoring the quality of elections across Europe, not just the EU. Now, the OSCE monitors have produced a kind of summary report, which expressed concerns on various issues, as I just mentioned. But they will, over the next couple of days, produce a full report. And I think it is that full report that all European leaders will study very carefully before formulating a reaction. It's not going to make pretty reading, to be honest.
But even if it doesn't, John, what difference can that make? Because we're not talking about a situation with Europe and Turkey of 10 years ago, when there was a process of Turkey's gradual accession towards the European Union. That's been pretty much put on hold. Turkey's even now suggesting that it doesn't really see its future in Europe, certainly in the way that it would have 10, 15 years ago. So it's quite hard, isn't it, for European leaders and European civil society to have much influence on what's happening in Turkey?
I think that the question of Turkish accession to the European Union is important. You're right. I mean, 10, 15 years ago, there was a much bigger head of steam behind this. But over much of this year, having indicated, you're right to say, for a while that Turkey wasn't that interested, Erdogan was going into reverse, remember? I mean, we had this talks about the restarting the accession process back in, was it January, February? I think it would be much more difficult for the European Union to take that process forward if the OSCE report is completely damning. Also, you have to remember that Turkey depends very heavily economically on the European Union, not just the trade and things that governments aren't going to interfere with in any case, but also significant amounts of European aid going to Turkey still. And it's unlikely that that's going to be increased if Europeans conclude that Erdogan in any sense stole this election.
On the point of what else can be done from outside of Turkey, Peter, there is this issue then of, you know, does the West need Turkey at the moment more than Turkey needs the West? When you look at the situation with Syria on Turkey's doorstep, where the West has been very, very keen to have Turkey involved in the fight against ISIS, there is this sense that, you know, the West needs Turkey a little bit more.
There is that sense, and I think, again, it's being leveraged. You know, the EU is basically in a position of dependency in terms of the Turkish-Syrian border, and the terrible migrant problem at the moment, you know, which is a social and political catastrophe that's unfolding right before our eyes. You know, Turkey is a key player in that, you know, and talk of the accession to the EU, you know, that's a huge step forward and a huge kind of signal to Turkey that they are, you know, being courted, if you like, by the EU. I said this a few weeks ago, but you know, with the EU crumbling before our eyes, I'm still wondering why they would want to be part of it, as everyone's trying to bail out as we speak. But you know, it's a very, very powerful gesture.
Why would they want to be part of it? I crumble before your eyes. Well, we can have a long talk about that. I think if you're sitting in Ankara and your choice is between joining the Middle East and joining the EU, even now, the EU looks a much better bet. You think the EU is crumbling. Look at the Middle East.
That's a good point.
Peter, if you were a Turkish opposition leader or an independent Turkish journalist or a member of civil society in Turkey, what would you be planning to do right now? What are the next steps for those people?
Well, I think it's a grassroots campaign. At least, you know, after this election, even though it was something of a, you know, people are talking about a landslide, but they didn't get enough power that they just can't, you know, usher in new laws without a referendum. And a referendum, I think, is an important point in which opposition groups around civil rights in particular, but also, I guess, the pro-Kurdish parties would want to kind of really, really kind of campaign upon. As soon as that referendum process, which is a very, very important kind of power balancer here, as soon as that's taken out of the picture, then things will get even nastier than they are now, I think. But I think grassroots campaigning, definitely, in order for the oppositional groups to kind of, you know, their opinion was shut out of this election process in quite a vicious and quite a violent manner. So rather than turning to violence again, you know, to kind of have some faith in the democratic process, hopefully.
I think I'm glad you mentioned the referendum. As you say, he needs a referendum. He's 14 seats short in Parliament of the number he would have needed to be able to change the constitution without a referendum. And he needs a referendum to change the constitution to allow the presidency greater powers. Remember, this is the great Erdogan project. Mm. He came in, the first elected president of Turkey, to a position which was largely ceremonial. And he's been busy remoulding it to be a serious, powerful executive presidency. But to take that forward, he needs to change the constitution. So a referendum, as you rightly say, which is risky. The numbers right now don't look that good for a referendum.
Well, there's also the issue as well, John, isn't there, that not everyone within the AKP would necessarily be out on the streets calling for Erdogan to have more power. There are still some within his party, you know, even whisper it, his Prime Minister, Ahmet Davutoğlu, who would lose a lot of his powers if there were a successful referendum, may not actually want President Erdogan to have more powers.
Absolutely right. Through all this, you need to remember the AKP is, we dignify it with the name, a party. It's glued together various parts of a broadly Islamist movement, which it's got lots of factions and lots of personal hatreds and vendettas going on. A thing like a referendum might just split the party. You're quite right.
Okay, let's move on. New online spying laws will be unveiled in the UK later this week. According to what is known so far about the new bill, technology firms would be required to keep records of the websites people have used and details of when they accessed them for 12 months. Privacy campaigners have questioned the need for a change in the law. British Prime Minister David Cameron has defended the proposed new web surveillance powers, saying the internet cannot become a safe space for terrorists and criminals. The bill will be presented in Parliament on Wednesday. Peter, there's been a lot of use of the argument that you often get whenever a government wants to introduce new laws about what we can and can't do, of, well, look, if you've done nothing wrong, then you don't have anything to be worried about. Is it a bit more complicated than that?
Yes, I think it is a lot more complicated than that. You know, They've been trying to do this for some years now, and this is kind of being pitched as a watered-down version of the Snooping Charter or Snoopers Charter. But it's still pretty Big Brotherish in many respects. The usual suspects, child molesters, terrorists and drug dealers are the ones that are used to justify why, the UK is being transformed into a country of citizens, into one that's a country of suspects. And the problem with, if you haven't got anything to hide, then you shouldn't be worried about, you can take that to the nth degree and say, well, let's have surveillance cameras in your living room. If you haven't got anything to hide, what's the problem with it? Or in your bedroom. And that can be taken so far. It's not about whether you've got anything to hide or not. It's about what kind of climate and atmosphere you want to live in as free individuals, and is it one in which it's going to be permeated by paranoia, kind of circa Soviet paranoia.
And John, there's also this issue of, you're making a face there, I don't think you necessarily agree, but let me just ask you on this. There is also this issue, isn't there, that in the past, police have used powers that were supposedly to prevent terrorism for other purposes. For instance, the political editor of the Sun newspaper had his phone records looked at by the police under terrorism powers when, he hadn't been talking to terrorists. It was about them trying to find out who his source had been.
Yes, that's right. If you are going to pass laws like this, you have to draft them very, very tightly. The problem with what the police did in that case was that the law was sufficiently loose that they were just about within their rights to act as they did. Remember, this was explored exhaustively in the courts, and I like to think that we've learned from this process and that next time round the law won't be subject to that kind of abuse. I have to say that having sat on the other side of the fence for a long time and looked at massive amounts of the raw intelligence that comes in, the idea that anybody is going to be remotely interested in what goes on in people's living rooms, in their bedrooms or whatever, when you've been through your 40th hour of video of the day looking for a terrorist, you really don't care about people's private lives. The state simply does not have the resources to snoop in the way that I think a lot of people think it will.
But surely the issue, John, isn't that that you'll have someone who's looking for a terrorist and go, oh, I'll just have a look at this person's private life. But is the fact that these laws will be able to be used for suspected crimes that aren't terrorism, as we've seen with other so-called terrorism acts, that it then becomes just another tool that police are able to use and sort of justify to themselves afterwards.
That is why the wording of these laws is so critically important. And we haven't seen a draft yet.
No, but I must say there's no evidence on any law passed so far that these lessons you say have been learned.
If you look at the sequence of laws that have been passed, as you say, there have been several, there is a move towards ever tighter legislation. The first laws were effectively the police charter. The police could go off and do pretty much what they liked. And slowly, the police ability to wriggle, as it were, within the legislation has been curtailed and curtailed and curtailed. I very much hope that when this law goes through, and I support it, I think it should go through, that it will be sufficiently tightly drafted that police, for whatever reason, can only use it for the purposes for which it's intended.
Is there... I mean, it would be wrong for us not to at least mention Edward Snowden here, piece in that, the whole terms of the debate of what governments can and cannot see or listen into or hear about have changed fundamentally since his revelations.
They certainly have, and I guess we've got one up on the United States. At least there's a law that's kind of making it legal. This mass kind of gathering of people's kind of internet habits, whereas the NSA bypassed most laws and acted illegally for the most part. But what really surprised us about the NSA, scandal PRISM was just the sheer amount of data that was being gathered and the sophisticated nature of the algorithms and programs that were being used to process it. We don't want a situation like that in our country. It's a classic political theory debate, security, but at what price? And also I get the feeling that they haven't really thought about it. Theresa May's office hasn't really thought about that very much, you know. For example, saying that they want to kind of curtail the use of encryption, which would be impossible to enact. And also, you know, if all of a sudden all of the systems in the UK had no encryption so that the government could gather data, you know, it would open a huge opportunity for theft, identity theft. The bad guys would actually love that. So I don't think they've thought about it really that much.
I'm afraid we're going to leave it just there for now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. When we're back, we'll be talking about South Korean and Japanese leaders meeting for the first time in quite a long time. And we'll also be talking about Australia's Prime Minister scrapping Knights and Dames. Stay tuned.
There's a new Monocle book weighing in at 400 pages that's packed with everything you need to know about making a great place to live. The Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes is filled with handsome residences and all the contacts you need to make a home that will last a lifetime. It's a book that celebrates the people who know homes should be able to cope with kids, dogs and a few scuff marks. It's a book that knows a home is only as good as the community it's in. And it's a book that takes you through the front doors of everything from mountain hideaways to modernist towers. So be cozy and buy your copy today at monocle.com.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, at 1821 here in London, 1321 in New York City. Still with me here, John Everard and Peter Fleming. South Korean President Park Geun-hye and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe have today held their first formal bilateral talks since both leaders took office. The meeting is a diplomatic breakthrough for Abe, who sought talks with Park to improve relations in the face of an increasingly assertive China. And the Park-Abe meeting comes after a summit of South Korean, Japanese and Chinese leaders on Sunday, where they agreed to restore what had been an annual forum to work towards greater regional cooperation. John Everard, this is a step in the right direction, isn't it?
Absolutely. At last, they're talking again. A basic sort of primer for Asian politics for anybody who's not really familiar with it. Think yourself back to when you were 6 or 7 years old and you were in the kindergarten and you had best friends and suddenly they all went sour and you wouldn't talk to them for ages and ages and ages, and then you had a big kiss and you made up. Asian leaders behave in exactly that way, and we are in the middle of an Asian love-in. That the Chinese, who have been saying very, very nasty things about the Japanese, and the South Koreans, who have been accusing the Japanese of not being sufficiently apologetic for the comfort women of the Second World War, all of a sudden, big handshakes, they've worked out some kind of modus vivendi, and they have had quite a productive meeting. The world breathes a huge sigh of relief. Notice the choreography, that it all happened in Seoul, in South Korea. Li Keqiang, the Premier of China, comes first to Seoul. So he and President Park Geun-hye have a bilateral. They're joined by Abe, Prime Minister Abe of Japan, for a day, and then the Chinese go, leaving the Japanese and the South Koreans together. So it's what you call variable geometry. You get not only a three-way summit out of the deal, you get two nice, spicy bilaterals where probably quite a lot of real business was done. This is a rare outbreak of common sense, and yes, I hope it continues. I hope it will be encouraged.
Peter, they have a lot to talk about, obviously, not just about matters of the past, and we might come on to that in a moment, but also issues of trade and issues to do with security within the region right now. What do you think, you know, is likely to be the result of these meetings or further down the line?
Well, hopefully, and I concur with John that this is a really positive outcome. You know, and China has been very involved, I think, as you mentioned earlier, in the bilateral discussions. And China's got a big stake in all of this as well, as they're building their islands as we speak, that the US is getting very, very nervous about in the South China Sea. So what is going to what's going to be quite important, I think, is sorting out the territory disputes that have not been sorted out, and particularly the islands in the south of Japan, which is a very, very contentious issue. And I guess that would be something that would be very important for, you know, taking this step forward even in a more positive direction. And of course, by the way, South Korean pop music is the most popular in Japan, so I think that's probably at the heart of all of this.
That certainly helps. But it is interesting, John, that Japan and South Korea, you know, which are they're two democracies, they're two capitalist societies. They have these soft power links, as Peter's just alluded to there, with pop music and soap operas that go both ways, and yet their inability to be friendly to each other at a governmental level is astonishing. It was as if Britain and Germany still wouldn't talk to each other right now.
Well, no, not quite. They go through phases of having bad relations. Remember, not so long ago, I mean, they were co-hosting a World Cup.
Not very happily.
Okay, but they were doing it. I mean, can you imagine sort of two countries in Europe trying that and getting away with it? Anyway, they one or another, they did actually pull it off. The problem, as so often in Asia, is the past, different perceptions of history, and the way in particular that the Japanese Imperial Army behaved during the period of Japanese supremacy, which ended in 1945. It's clear that some kind of deal has been done behind the scenes between Prime Minister Abe and President Park Geun-hye to enable the handshake that we saw just a few hours ago. And it almost certainly involves a form of words around the comfort women, as they're called, the many Koreans who were forced into sexual slavery to satiate the cravings of Japanese soldiers. The Koreans remain very angry about this. The Japanese on their side feel that every time they offer what they think is a sufficient apology, the Koreans move the goalposts and demand more and more and more again. So, you know, let's hope that this issue is finally put to rest in a way that keeps everybody happy.
Okay, let's finish today with news from Australia, where Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has scrapped knighthoods from the nation's honours system. The move comes after previous Prime Minister Tony Abbott caused bewilderment by reintroducing the scheme and then awarding a knighthood to Prince Philip, the Queen's husband, who, let's be honest, probably had a few awards already. Peter Fleming, you're a Kiwi. Please don't mock the Australians too much. But this is, I think, it's fair to say, been a move that's been welcomed by most Australians.
I think it's a cleansing period here now to get rid of the kind of the history of the Abbott, the fateful Abbott years. I think there was only two of them, but he packed in enough blunders.
It feels like an era.
It does. From eating raw onions to giving, you know, Prince Philip a knighthood, which even the Queen looked embarrassed about. You know, trying to figure out what exactly was going on. Was it a hoax, you know? But in Australia, you know, great sense of humour, very resilient people, and very ironic. And so what they called the nightmare, with a K, is thankfully over, and now they can kind of move on a bit.
John Everard, could you ever imagine in this country something similar happening with a Prime Minister saying, you know what, these are a bit antiquated. We talk about the British Empire, which doesn't exist anymore. We should get rid of them.
I suppose I can imagine it, but I don't think it's very likely. I think that the honour system is fairly well rooted in British society, and I don't sense a great call to change too much of it. In Australia too, I mean, essentially the reason why knighthoods and damehoods have been scrapped is because Tony Abbott blundered. What was he thinking of? I mean, just the photograph you see of the Queen solemnly handing her husband a knighthood.
Well, it was also that they have a system already, the Order of Australia. There is a way for people in Australia that are deemed worthy to be given these sorts of awards.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, most countries have these systems of one kind or another. People associate them with conservative Western countries. Remember, the Soviet Union had this incredible system of honours and sub-honours in different classes, and you, depending on what letter you had after your name, you're allowed into this club or not into that club. You know, this is not just the purview of Western democracies.
In the final 30 seconds, Peter, is it taking too much of a leap to suggest that Malcolm Turnbull, who is a Republican, may be tempted at some stage stage in his premiership to consider having another referendum on whether Australia should be a republic?
Well, you know, the last time the referendum was posited by the Labor Party, and the Liberal Party, the Conservative Party, was very against it. But this time we've got a Liberal Party Prime Minister who's a staunch Republican. It could very well be, you know, it depends on the feeling within the country. But he has actually explicitly said that it's not exactly one of his top priorities. So it just remains to be seen.
Okay, we'll leave it there. John Everard and Peter Fleming, thank you both very much indeed. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Mark Cassippi, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Jamie Waters. The studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. The next half hour, Carlotta Ribello will be here, and then it's Culture with Rob. That's at 1900. We'll be back same time tomorrow. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.